What a finisher in front of. He didn't have a weakness, Kites.
Yeah.
He was good in the air. It was good with both feet. He was
to
quick.
Retire. That's mad.
What a player.
The Fantasy Football Show.
Hello, patrons. Welcome to round two of our nostalgic look at major tournaments played in Germany, or in this case, obviously, West Germany. And round two is quite appropriate because we never fucking made it. But at least, unlike 1974, I suppose we did make it to this tournament. Clates is with me again. How are you, Clates?
I'm good. I've got my Premier League years-esque random facts from the year 1988. I've got two for this one. I was struggling to find a lot. So, are you aware of the movie? Have you seen the film Rain Man? With Tom Cruise, Dustin Hoffman.
I mean, people are going to laugh if I say no.
Yeah, great film. That was released in 1988. And the band Guns N' Roses, they rose to fame with their debut album, Appetite for Destruction, which apparently
became... banned?
Pardon?
Why would it? You said the band Guns... Oh,
fuck
the
it.
Band. So literally, sorry, it's terrible. I should start this whole podcast again. You said band, and I thought you meant they were banned. As in, no, like, no. UEFA giving them a two-year ban. Like, what's going on?
So, they're my two fun facts for 1988. Another one was, you were 4 years old, right? So you remember this very well.
Yeah, fluently. I mean, I don't even... My first tournament really was Euro 92. My mum tells me that when England lost to West Germany in 1990 in the semi-final, that I cried a lot. I have no recollection of it. I have no recollection of watching the games or anything from Italia 90. Euro 92, yeah, I remember all of it. I remember we at home, we had a sofa. And I don't know why, but it was like, it was slightly away from the wall. And I remember standing behind it, literally doing the old, I haven't captained him, hiding behind the sofa. Yeah. Against Sweden, and stayed there for all, because we were obviously, we'd scored early. Our only goal in a shitty tournament, and we're winning and we're going through. I remember standing behind that sofa when Thomas Brolin ultimately knocked us out, deservedly so as well. It's worth saying. So 1992 is my real memory. I remember 1994 getting up at like 6 a.m. to watch whatever the like 12:30 game was before I went to school.
Huh.
Recording it. And all those days it would have been like recorded on the old VHS.
Yeah.
You probably ain't even like, what's some VHS?
I've got one, to be fair.
Have you really?
Yeah, so I think I just caught the end of that kind of era. I was born in 95.
I remember getting particularly upset one morning, putting the TV on to watch Cameroon against Sweden. And I know, right? But it was an all right game, but it was destroyed for me because I put the TV on. And as I put the TV on to then go and put the video recorder on, it was literally straight to the fucking news showing Sweden's equaliser to make it 2-2. I was like, great. Cheers.
You know what the main pods, when you say you've been at Tottenham, you come back, you've stuck a game on record, you've come back, I can see where it's come from. Cameroon, Sweden in the 90s.
Yeah, that was, I mean, once that's I got class. Into it, mate, that was it. Dedication, 100%.
Yeah,
watched every game, mate. I remember as well watching the Netherlands in 94. Who was their last group game against? Morocco, I think. And we lived on the 7th floor of a flat in Hornsey. That's where I grew up. Hornsey Lane. Literally at the Haringey-Islington border, basically.
Okay.
And I remember this absolutely crazy fight going on outside between about 20 people. And this was middle of the afternoon. And my dad was like, come and have a look at this. I'm like, I'm watching the fucking Netherlands. Fuck off, man. Didn't care. I just went, any football I could consume, I was consuming at that point. But I didn't consume Euro 1988 when I was 4 years old. So it is like a little bit like yesterday. We are working off historical references. Yeah. The slight difference with this one to 1974 is I've seen a lot of these players play. Whether it's in European competition, in later major tournaments, or even with some in obviously the Premier League. as well. Obviously, I'm familiar with all the English names.
Which
and
ones
very
do you
much
have
a lot
like
of the
best
Irish
memories
names
of
well.
from this tournament?
I mean, when you say this tournament, Marco van Basten stands out massively. One of the things I didn't know, actually, ironically, was that he was left out for the first game against the Soviet Union.
Came on as a sub, didn't he?
Yeah, and apparently he wanted to leave. He wanted to leave the tournament. He was like, I'm not fucking playing, don't want to fucking be here, basically. Would end up being top goal scorer, scored the most ridiculous goal in the final in the second group game. He's back in the team, scores a hat-trick against England. I'm ruining a lot of this story, but that's the big one. Outside of the English players, I think when you think Euro 88, the first thing that comes to your mind is, it's interesting, like 74, it's the Dutch again.
Yeah.
But it's Van Basten.
And I guess from my perspective, like, I obviously didn't really see a lot of these, but the names I kind of obviously know very well, like the Germans with Jürgen Klinsmann, Rudi Völler, the Italians with Gianluca Vialli, Maldini, Mancini. Obviously, that England team, I think, had quite a lot of talent in it as well. And even the Dutch, like Van Basten, Rijkaard, Ruud. So, I'm well familiar with a lot of these names. And I think that's where the kind of football nostalgia kicks in for me. But I never got the chance to really see them properly.
England were expected to do very well. We're essentially one of four favourites. West Germany as the hosts were favourites. Italy were very well fancied. And then I think from England's group, it was largely, England were probably the favourites to win the group, actually, and probably go through with the Netherlands. Remember, for the Dutch, they'd obviously had the 74 and the 78 World Cups, but then kind of disappeared again through the 80s. And obviously with them re-emerging. And I mean, for me growing up in my childhood through the 90s, like, the Dutch were always there and always one of the favourites for every competition. Like, when they didn't qualify for 2002, I spent a lot of the 2002 build-up thinking, this is so fucking weird that the Dutch aren't there.
Yeah.
But people, my dad's generation, been like, yeah, there's loads of tournaments that the Netherlands never qualified for and stuff.
It's interesting you said about kind of the English confidence going into it. Like, I was speaking to Mike Halpin, he's obviously a patron, and he remembers it quite well. And he was saying, hopes were high, especially after 86. He remembers there was a big 8-0 win against Turkey in qualifying as well. So, he said he was
even more impressively, which is probably a more darker look to try and find the footage. But we spoke on yesterday's pod about good Yugoslavian teams through that period. Yugoslavia were in England's group. England were 4-0 up in Yugoslavia in 25 minutes.
You didn't
go to these Eastern Bloc countries and do that sort of thing, right? So England were well fancied, had a lot of good firepower. Obviously, Gary Lineker had been Golden Boot winner at 1986. It was towards the end of Glenn Hoddle's period. There was a lot of angst that Glenn Hoddle didn't play in the first game against the Republic of Ireland, but then you still had these emerging players like John Barnes was coming through, etc. Brian Robson obviously led the team. My dad couldn't stand him, Brian Robson, by the way.
Really?
Yeah. The reason he couldn't stand him was because he felt that he denied Hoddle the place in the England team a lot. Right. I think most people probably in the 80s would say they probably should have just played together more.
Okay.
It's the reality. But it seemed like one or the other. And they were very different players. Brian Robson was all action. He was nicknamed Captain Marvel, right? So he was the prototype. The 80s player, proper boxed. And when you say box-to-box midfielder, Brian Robson comes to mind as one of the top for doing that. Whereas Glenn could ping like 60-yard balls on a fucking pound coin, mate, like wherever he wanted it. So they were very different players. We probably should have played together.
Okay.
A lot more didn't. I mean, we look back at Glenn Hoddle, the amount of caps he had in his career. And obviously, I've grown up kind of thinking him as one of Tottenham's greatest ever players. You think that's fucking shocking. But then you look at Gascoigne's caps and it's similar.
Yeah.
But Gascoigne, self-inflicted, the injuries, the off-the-field stuff with Hoddle, just it wasn't preferred a lot because he was kind of anti the England style of play of that era of knock it long to the number nine and play from there, basically.
He was more cultured.
Well, basically, yeah. It's one of them. It's probably like a bit of when you listen to players from other nations talk about Paul Scholes through the 2000s, I mean, you listen to people like Zidane's like, the fuck how you used Paul Scholes and stuff like that is disgusting.
Yeah.
It's like, he'd walked in our team or something. You think, what, that great French team? It's like, yeah, of course he would have, like, no doubt about it. And all the others said similar about Hoddle. Like, the Brazilians couldn't believe that Hoddle wasn't like the key player for England through the '80s and stuff like that. But like, you're mad. You've got this incredible footballer who is different to anything else you've got, and you don't use it.
I wonder, it's very different, but I wonder if we'll be having conversations about Trent in the future, looking back in terms of a unicorn of a player.
Maybe. Might divide. I mean, it's only these great players that do divide. I think Trent's got a way to go to be considered part of that. One of the big things leading up to the tournament was concern about off-field matters. There had obviously, unfortunately, been the Hazel disaster in the 1985 European Cup final when Juventus played Liverpool. And unfortunately, a wall collapsed and it was 39 Juventus fans died. It was quite a hangover of that into Italia 90. But essentially, it was kind of the final straw for many of the football authorities to ban English clubs from European competition.
Yeah.
And it was only after Italia 90 that English football fans were allowed back into competition. I mean, 1985 was also the year, I believe, of the famous riot at Kenilworth Road when primarily Millwall fans stormed the pitch after an FA Cup quarterfinal against Luton. But it's also believed that it wasn't just Millwall. It was pretty much all the London clubs just wanted to set off because they were so angry of what was happening politically in the country as well. But you've got 3 years worth of English fans not being able to go on tour in Europe, and all West Germany's fairly accessible. Yeah. Add in the, tension because of the Second World War, etc. I imagine it was probably a relief to the authorities in 1974 when hooliganism was originally beginning to flare its head that England probably didn't qualify. It was probably quite a relief to people. It's probably considered 1988 one of the worst ones for hooliganism. There was a lot of trouble in Italy in 1980. And many of you more my age will remember English fans being complete dickheads in Belgium during Euro 2000s, just being dickheads with themselves and the police, basically. Okay. 1988 kind of depends who you're listening to for accounts. So several accounts will be like, you know, the English want to kick off. You can imagine when the English played the Dutch in the second game, the Dutch can look after themselves from that perspective as well. And even if the first game, all the Irish ever want to do is go and party, right?
Yeah.
And obviously this was Ireland's first major tournament. They want to go and party. But obviously, again, there's tensions from an Irish versus English standpoint there.
Yeah.
And you get certain accounts of there's so much trouble, the English smashed up this, that, and the other. But I read one report from a German officer who spoke about a particular problem in Dusseldorf. Near a train station where there were 300 arrests.
Oh, dear.
And it was largely reported that it's the English. But this official said that there were 11 Englishmen arrested from that 300. He said all arrests were Germans looking for trouble.
No way.
Ah.
Yeah. Interesting. We need better PR.
I've been watching a programme this week which is more centred around English fans at Italia 90 that was screened a few years ago on Channel 4. Because what happened in 88, and bearing in mind the English clubs banning from Europe, England were essentially told going into Italia 90 that if your fans misbehaved, you're out of the tournament. We will pull you out.
Yeah.
And there was concern, particularly before England played Belgium in 1990, if the game would even go ahead because of trouble that had happened in Rimini, which was nowhere near Bologna, where it was about 70 miles away from where England were playing Belgium in Bologna, is like a holiday resort where the English can go in Italy. Think of your Italian version of like a Mallorca or something, for example. But Italy had played one night and then there was tension between the Italians and the English and stuff like that. And a lot of the reports there is like the Italians went for the English. But that didn't matter. So the police there just like scooped up anything English that was in the way. They put them all in jail. Next morning, got chartered flights, put them all in the plane, got them out of the country.
Bloody hell.
And at that point, because of that, and that was such a big headline, the English team were genuinely concerned that they were going to get told go home before the game against Belgium. Then they won, and then the media narrative changed from hooliganism to this great, this team that was suddenly bringing joy and Paul Gascoigne, et cetera, et cetera. I had an epiphany watching this, actually, that the change from the hooliganism culture to kind of the start and then the Premier League and money, all that, the epiphany was Gascoigne's tears changed.
Okay.
And I realized this because it was a man showing a great man who everyone was looking up to, this that idolizing the way he was playing football, who showed weakness.
Yeah, and vulnerability.
Didn't lash out in because he was a clown, right?
Yeah.
Across the white line, he was a player. His epiphany of like everyone looking at, oh my God, this great man, and we all idolize. He's standing there on a football pitch and he's crying because he's just found out he can't play in a World Cup final.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it psychologically changed the psyche of culture from there a little bit. Then it was all seaters. A lot of things came together because of all seat stadiums after, unfortunately, what obviously happened at Hillsborough, etc. Yep. But it didn't kick off as badly as perhaps reported.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah.
1988. Certainly there were dickheads there who couldn't wait. And unfortunately, when you do put too much drink in football fans, particularly of English, but you know, there's plenty of others in Europe who drink, will affect them as well and stuff. Yeah, they go over the top. It is interesting because to reference the Irish, it's always the same with the Irish. Just want to party.
Yeah,
you
they just want to have a lot.
Never find any accounts of Republic of Ireland football fans causing trouble at football matches. If it is, it's because people have targeted them and they may have had to defend themselves. They just want to go and enjoy themselves. You do reflect and you go, why are the Irish like that, but English can't be? You're going to see dickheads on Sunday.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
For those who don't know, Clayton's going to be in Germany for the opener against Serbia, which I'm sure you're now aware, Clayton, is the biggest security risk football match at the tournament.
I've seen, and no alcohol being served at that game.
Yeah, I'd probably go to Schalke quite late. The only problem with going to Schalke quite late is the trains in Germany are terrible.
They're awful. Eh? I don't know where this myth
like a
comes
myth.
From.
Yeah. German efficiency. No, their trains are worse than ours.
Like, this is shocking. Yeah. Anyway, tangent. Yeah.
Yes. Okay, let's talk actually some football is probably what people want to hear about. So
before we get into it though, I didn't realize France were the defending champions
and didn't qualify.
They didn't even qualify.
Yeah,
that's mad.
And didn't qualify because the Soviet Union, and we'll talk about it in a bit, and like comfortably finished above them in the group. Group one held West Germany, Italy, Spain, Denmark. Now, so on paper, you look at a group of death, and it fucking feels like one to me when I look about it. The poor Danes. I mean, I guess it's not too dissimilar to the group that Albania are landing in this particular tournament with Spain, Italy.
True.
I mean, you probably can substitute West Germany for Croatia, considering their recent World Cup performances. And the closer it gets, the more I hear people talking up Croatia, actually, for this particular tournament. And I don't particularly see it myself till they knock us out in a quarterfinal or something. That's a possibility. It's interesting you mentioned France not qualifying as the reigning champions. They were the last host nation to win the tournament.
Wow.
Which is mad. And the reason that's particularly mad with the European Championships is it is largely hosted by major nations who will go into the tournaments as near favourites.
Yeah.
West Germany, 88, semi-finalists. Sweden, 1992 semi-finalist, fine. England semi-finalist 96, Netherlands semi-finalist 2000, Portugal finalist 2004, 08 and 12 you can skip, 16 France losing finalist, 20 was shared, but it kind of felt like our tournament, Clay, considering the semi-finals and final was at Wembley and England played six of their seven games there, losing finalists. So the last host nation to win a European Championship was France in 1984. It feels due. For those who are German and think it's their time, it might very well be, because that's a remarkable statistic.
Yeah, that's crazy.
No host nation's won the Euros for 40 years, mate.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Good trivia.
So group one, and it's two groups, this tournament. It's an 18 tournament, which when you reflect on it, is like, ooh, wow. I mean, we talk about how easy it is to qualify for this one now with 24 teams. Like, if you're a nation like England, you've got to be fucking drunk not to make it, basically.
Yeah.
But to qualify for eight, you one step wrong in qualifying.
Yeah, and that's it.
You were potentially in a lot of trouble from that perspective. So the opener was West Germany against Italy. And arguably, a lot of people were tipping this up to not just be the first game, but also potentially the last game. Both very well fancied. Roberto Mancini, who we all know, obviously scored the opener for Italy. Have you seen the controversial equaliser, Clates?
I haven't actually, no.
So it's a free kick that's scored by Andreas Bremer, who would go on to score free kick against, deflected free kick against England at Italia 90. But the decision of the free kick is somewhat controversial.
Okay.
Walter Zenga, the Italian goalkeeper, who I always remember for having a massive loose chain around his neck.
Really?
Yeah, it always. It always wore a chain that was like so fucking baggy, clear as day. There's no way you'd be able to wear it.
A chain?
Yeah, a chain around his neck, like a necklace or chain, yeah. Whatever you want to call it. And it was always baggy, right? He probably could have put it around his waist. It was so big, right? You wouldn't put it around my waist, but obviously he was a professional footballer. You might have been all right. He got penalised for taking more than 4 steps. So there was a rule. Kate was looking at me like, what?
I think I've seen it. You were only allowed like 1 step,
three,
right?
Steps.
Or was it 3? Okay, yeah. I've seen
3 steps.
Old.
So wherever, once you had the ball in your hands, you weren't allowed to take more than 4 steps as a goalkeeper. Now, it was a bit like the 6-second rule now.
Okay. It wasn't really
penalised for it. And it's also a very good change that they made. I mean, quite why you'd restrict goalkeepers to that. I'm not sure, but yeah. It was not a rule that got changed to like the 21st century. But you never saw it get penalised. Anyway, he gets penalised for that. And West Germany and Italy draw. And I guess under this circumstance, top two going through from a difficult group, first game, they're both probably fairly content with that outcome, I would suggest. Spain beat Denmark.
Was this Denmark team, did this have Michael Laudrup in it?
The outstanding Michael Laudrup.
Yeah, that's another.
Also had in goal a very young Peter Schmeichel.
No way.
Yeah, and I didn't realise that, but they'd had a really good team that people liked from the 1986 World Cup. They lost 3-2 to Spain, didn't disgrace themselves by any means. In fact, it's probably remembered as the most offensive and exciting Danish team, I would say. The Danes would then lose to West Germany 2-0, which featured a goal from the great Jürgen Klinsmann. And then Italy would beat Spain in what kind of really felt like almost a deciding match. Because I think by that point, with that being the fourth of the 6 games played, you knew Denmark weren't qualifying, having lost the first two. West Germany on 4 points, obviously Spain on 3, Italy 1. Italy really obviously couldn't really afford to lose at this point. And they scored with about 15 minutes to go from Gianluca Vialli.
Vialli now, this time. You don't succeed. Gianluca Vialli. Persistence paying off.
Who would obviously go on and play for Chelsea, win European Cup with Juventus. One thing is extremely striking from the goal, Clates. Know what it is?
Go on.
Well, it's difficult to know that it's Gianluca Vialli.
Why is that?
The amount of fucking hair on his head.
Yeah, I only know him as a bald guy.
It's a little bit unrecognisable. Italy would beat Denmark 2-0 in the final game of the group, but they would finish below West Germany by the virtue of 1 goal scored. Rudi Völler, who was Klinsmann's partner up front, was on quite a bit of a barren spell, but scored twice against Spain. One of the goals beautifully assisted by the great Lothar Matthäus, who went on to another level at the World Cup in 1990.
Rolf, well played. Matthäus, he resisted the challenge beautifully. Lothar Matthäus hoping to go all the way here. Oh, great ball, Rudi Völler, 2-0. Völler's second, Beckenbauer applauds. And the stadium roars.
The stakes in that game with West Germany, Spain must have been high, though. Because if Spain beat the West Germans, they would have gone through, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that must have been mad.
Yeah. Absolutely. But they've ended up winning it fairly comfortably in the end. Group two, as you probably know, the teams that were in it by now. So England, Republic of Ireland, Netherlands, and the Soviet Union. As said, this was Ireland's first major tournament.
And their manager was English.
Was English, Jack Charlton, who was welcomed, let's say, with mixed feelings when he was appointed in 1986, because I think there was quite a bit of a pushback to appointing an Englishman, and I certainly understand the reasons behind that. But you know, he was very clear in his ways in terms of, you judge me on what happens on the football pitch.
I'm sure I read somewhere he was part of the 66 squad.
Yeah, he was in the, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Of course, him and Bobby were both part of the team in 1966. That Irish squad had a host of names that you'd recognise. I mean, the whole squad essentially near enough played the top division in England, or basically played for Celtic. That was it. Yeah. So there were a few players at Celtic, goalkeeper Paddy Bonner, Chris Morris and Mick McCarthy.
Oh, yeah.
Who obviously went on to manage several clubs in the Premier League. But to give you some of these names, and a few of these became managers as well. Chris Hughton was a great fullback at Tottenham. But yeah, a super, super fullback. Could play left or right back. Brilliant fullback. Kevin Moran was at Manchester United centre back, was the first player ever sent off in the FA Cup final. Paul McGrath, teammate, midfielder at that stage, would play centre back later in his career, won PFA Player of the Year in 91-92, despite being drunk for most of the season. That's a true story. Ronnie Whelan at Liverpool, Ray Houghton at Liverpool, John Aldridge at Liverpool. Remember, Liverpool were the best team in the country at this point as well. Tony Cascarino, who apparently played illegally. Admit himself, he never had an Irish grandparent, apparently. But yeah, there were some good players there. John Sheridan was a young player at Leeds, was a really cultured player, was very good at Sheffield Wednesday through the 90s. Niall Quinn played up front, who was at Arsenal at the time.
Yep.
So, I mean, if you compare the Irish squad of then to now, what a good team they had
there. Yeah, brilliant.
What a really good team. That said, they weren't given much hope of progressing. And no one particularly fancied them to do anything against England in the opener. But part of the story with Ireland goes back to how they qualified as well. Because they needed a little bit of help to do so. So going into the penultimate set of qualifying fixtures, Ireland need a lot of help to qualify, basically. It's a 5-team group, and Ireland kind of had the short straw of not playing in the last round of fixtures. They basically needed to beat Bulgaria. They needed Scotland to stop Belgium from winning. And then they needed Scotland to go to Bulgaria and win.
Yeah.
To qualify. Ireland beat Bulgaria 2-0, goals from McGrath and Moran. And Scotland held up the first part of the bargain by beating Belgium 2-0, goals from Ali McCoist and Paul McStay. But it was no expectation of Scotland to get anything in Bulgaria. Bulgaria hadn't lost at home for around about 6 years. And on the eve of the game, several of Scotland's top players were pulling out through injury. There was also nothing for Scotland to play for. They couldn't qualify. But the Scots held their own, and with 4 minutes to go, Gary Mackay would only play four times for Scotland, but did play over 500 times for Hearts, for those who are interested, scored the only goal of the game, which pleased Scots, but sent Irish men and women and babies and children into raptures, and Ireland would qualify for their first tournament. So there's a little miracle behind the fact that they'd even qualified, was they really needed help.
The Scots must have been so pissed off. Scotland.
So here you go. I've managed to get you into this as well, Scotland. Well done. You beat Belgium and Bulgaria in qualifying. And I don't know if because of that, there's maintained a bit of a truce, Ireland, Scotland. I think there was a period later on where Ireland did a kind of a return for Scotland in a different set of qualifiers later on as well.
Okay.
So they got there, not by chance, deserved to get there, but they needed a bit of help. They're not expected to do anything. But I guess that probably along with beating Italy in USA 94, this probably remains their biggest ever result. And I guess, bloody hell, first ever game at a major tournament, you beat your rivals.
Yeah.
That's what it is, I think, to the Irish. I mean, they're on Northern Ireland or England. But in terms of a viewpoint as well, I suppose, in the shadow, etc., you're beating England doesn't
like
get
you say,
any
it was their first ever
major
international tournament as well, right? Like, what a way to introduce yourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Won 1-0 with a headed goal from Ray Houghton.
Together, Galvin pulling it across. A missed kick by Sansom. In goes Aldridge. And Houghton! 1-0! And Ray Houghton has stopped the breakthrough!
I think Ronnie Whelan hit the bar in the second half as well. A lot of the accounts, though, and I've not watched a lot of the game back, suggest that England did miss some very good chances, and very unusually, Gary Lineker missed the majority of them. In the other game, the Soviet Union would beat Netherlands 1-0, which has blasted the group wide open, basically, and essentially means the loser of the England-Netherlands second match is almost definitely going home here, basically, which wasn't what people thought was going to happen going into it. And Marco van Basten, as already said, was back in the Netherlands team and turned a very young Tony Adams, who was outstanding, by the way, mate. Did you ever have the pleasure of Tony Adams? You probably
didn't. Yeah, I've seen
him.
Yeah,
I did.
Yeah, I've met him.
Brilliant.
I've not got the
brilliant defender.
Biggest memories of him, but yeah, I was there to see him a few times.
One of the best centre-back organisers I've ever seen, I think.
Yeah, my dad has very fond memories of him. Like,
but he was only 21 in this tournament.
Wow, super young.
He really did get turned inside out.
Van Basten
England missed...
was young himself, though, wasn't he? He was like 23 or something.
Dave Watson played with him at Everton centre-back. England really missed the experience of Terry Butcher, who was unavailable. Butcher's become kind of part England legend, standing on the pitch with Gascoigne, doing the bit with his arms after we beat Belgium in the last 16, but also for a qualifier in Sweden for Italia 90, where if anyone ever wants to dress up in England gear, people dress up as Terry Butcher with the headband and bleeding from the head. Because, I mean, again, you'd no way you'd continue now. I mean, his shirt was red. England played in white. His shirt was red at the end of the game, basically. They missed his leadership at that point. Tony probably wasn't quite ready. But Van Basten scores three brilliant finishes. The first, he receives it back to goal. And he looks like he's going to shoot on his right. And he just cuts back across it and then finishes with his left. The second goal, he gets played in. England try to push out from a set play. Gets put in, brings it across to his left. Bang, bottom corner. A couple of minutes later, scores the third with a volley from a corner. He was just a super, super finisher. I was talking to Nico about him yesterday. And I was like, I can't tell you how good Marco van Basten was. Yeah. A player who had to retire at 28.
Oh, really?
Because of injury.
Oh, wow.
And actually, his injury problems had even happened before this.
I was just going to say, he'd recovered from an injury for this one. Yeah. Listening to James Horncastle talk about
his first season with Milan. What a finisher in front of him. He didn't have a weakness, Clates.
Yeah,
he was good in the air. It was good with both feet. It was quick.
That's mad.
What a player.
Pull it again against Stevens, and he's beaten him. Van Basten in the middle. Arriving now. That's Van Basten. It's Van Basten. It's a goal for Holland. Marco Van Basten. 2 minutes before half-time. And the Dutch delighted. Hullet did the damage on the left-hand side and whipped the ball in. Now then, Van Basten turning his man, and as the challenge came in, the ball shot past Shilton. And Kieft is there, and Hullet's there, and Kieft again. Back came Beardsley, Wouters with the mishit shot, Hullet. Oh, Van Basten! 2-1 Holland! England are behind for the second time. The Dutch supporters as the ball comes in. There's Hullet. Play to the left. Van Basten with the left foot shot and drilled into the corner. Kieft. Oh, Van Basten! Well, it's a hat-trick. And the Dutch have surely cracked it now. The third goal from the corner kick. The near post corner flicked on by Kieft. And Van Basten finished it at the far post.
One of the best finishers I've ever seen, without any doubt.
He would produce some good finishes.
If he's best strikers of all time that I've seen. I mean, for me, when I was a kid growing up, he was the best, and it wasn't anyone close as a number nine, no doubt about it. Brian Robson would equalise for England, but obviously not enough.
Yeah.
It is interesting though that. And obviously England would lose the last game to Soviet Union as well. So you think zero points.
Not a single point there.
I know. I mean, that is a fucking disaster. But the longer time's gone on, the more I think you read reports and go, well, against the Irish on a different day, Lineker would have scored a few and it would have been all right. And before the Dutch had scored in this one, England hit woodwork twice as well and had moments in the game, and people described the game as a largely very even contest until the Dutch got ahead again near the end. And then obviously by that point you're out and the last game doesn't particularly matter. Bobby Robson changes the team a little bit. So it's not remembered. I think probably 2014, despite again being in quite a challenging group, probably remembered worse. More, I don't know if it plays tricks on your mind over time.
Well, yeah, to be fair, I don't know if it's an age thing, but I never really see anyone looking back at 88 saying, yeah, they should have done this, that. But I see a lot of people reflecting on 2014. It's like, yeah, that was a failure.
Well, I think also it fell in 2014, fell in after a really disappointing Euro. You can say, oh, we got to the quarterfinals. We had, like, how much of the ball against Italy? Felt like 25%, basically. We got completely outplayed, shouldn't have even made it the penalties. And then afterwards, it's the tournament after is the Iceland.
Yeah.
So the 2014 falls in the middle of that, whereas 88, the team got to the World Cup quarterfinals in 86 and surprised doing so. And then obviously Italia 90 afterwards as well. So there's two pretty decent World Cups either side of this disaster. So it just almost feels like a bad one in the middle.
Yeah.
Euro 92 was also obviously
very bad. I wonder
what
the media vibe was when they came back. Like, I wonder if anyone was going for, like, Robson to leave or anything like that.
Oh, without that. I mean, people were going for that, going into Italia 90 and stuff as well, mate. No doubt about that at all. In the second group game for the Republic of Ireland, they led through Ronnie Whelan with I was going to say brilliant, a ridiculous goal scored from the edge of the area on the volley at, like, shoulder height.
No.
Which sounds like the best goal you've ever seen.
Yeah.
Goes top bin and stuff as well, by the way. He does shin it.
Bit of a Rooney against City one.
I read an account from an Irish fan who was there who said he never saw the goal because the Irish at the other end of the ground were too busy partying and doing the Mexican wave, which kind of summed them up. And back in those days, you'd be like, what happened? And it was like everyone around him was like doing the Mexican wave. No one had seen the goal. They were waiting for the crowd to come round to do the Mexican wave and stuff. And they all thought someone had said, you headed it in. Literally, they had no idea. Just the crowd's gone up and the ball's in the goal. And it was only when they'd seen it, like, passing a shop or something on a small TV, like, later that evening, were like, whoa, fucking hell. The accounts of this game is that the Irish absolutely should have won against the Soviet Union, who equalised with 15 minutes to go from Ole Protasov. But Ireland should have won.
Had they
done so, they would have gone through.
Going into the final game, 4 points from England and the Soviet Union. Not bad at all.
And then only needing a draw against the Netherlands to go through. On 4 points, though, can I pick you up on that? That was only 2 points for a win back then.
Ah, yeah.
Wasn't good three point. Points.
Yeah.
I think that changed for 1992. I think. I think Italia 90 was still 2 points for a win, I think.
Okay.
So 3 points. They only needed a draw against the Netherlands, though, to qualify. And they conceded with 8 minutes to go through a really bizarre goal from a defender, Wim Kieft, the goal where I think they're defending a set piece and a shot comes in from about 25 yards and it's hit directly into the ground and he's spinning. And Kieft, from the angle, just diverts this header that spins almost like weird, like kind of golf backspin. It spins away from Bonner and just crawls into the corner. He's got like no chance.
Wouters, Koeman, Kieft. It's a goal! Reiner Schmeichel's seems to be off the hook. And the Dutch, with a bit of good fortune, have scored the goal that may put the Republic of Ireland out. And Wim Kieft, one of the substitutes, got the touch that mattered. Wouters crossed, and look what happens here. Over Van Basten, the header out was by Paul McGrath. The shot was by Koeman. And then Kieft got ahead to it. It went to the left of Bonner, it bounced, it ran, it trickled, and it went in.
It's also a goal that shouldn't have stood.
Why is that? What happened?
Under the offside laws at the time, Van Basten was offside.
Feels like there were loads of dodgy goals back in this era.
But we ain't got social media to moan about it night and day, right? So it's just someone's recollection of telling you something later on. Obviously, it said the Soviet Union would beat England 3-1. And the Irish, very unfortunate to not make it to the semi-finals. There is some speculation, which I've read, I don't know how true it is, that there was an element of relief amongst the Irish FA that they'd gone out.
Why?
Because there was speculation that they would struggle to finance the team to travel for the semi-final.
Oh, wow.
I don't know how true that is, and it feels very difficult to believe, but that's something that I read.
If only GoFundMe was a thing back then.
The Irish would have funded it. No.
Oh, 100%, yeah.
One of the brilliant things, if you can find it, I think it is worth trying to find fan tales, particularly of this tournament and Italia 90, I think, because I think there's enough out there, and you've also got the difference of the English and the Irish travelling. Obviously, the English could do it kind of near enough by land. Ireland is two to get over. And it's interesting the various journeys people made. You do hear these tales of, you know, like when Ireland qualified, we went, we couldn't afford it, and we didn't stay anywhere. And loads of people can just kind of sleep rough during this as well. It's worth saying the weather was a lot better for this tournament than it had been in 1974. It was hot. A lot of the recounts, particularly of the England-Ireland game, was, oh my God, hot. And of course, the stadiums in 1988 was the same as 1974, all at the same, big athletic tracks, no roof, etc. So no shade, no protection, no nothing. If you were in it, you were in it. Jack Charlton, who always stood up during the games, famously against England, was like, fuck this. I'm going to sat down because the dugout was the only old style dugouts that used to kind of loop over the top. Yeah, just to get a bit of shade for a bit, right? So semi-finals. West Germany against the Netherlands.
Revenge.
Soviet Union against Italy. And yes, as you point out, revenge for the Dutch, but they would go behind first to a penalty from Lothar Matthäus 10 minutes into the second half with a penalty that I think is okay. But yeah, Jürgen Klinsmann did certainly make a meal of things. We know that he had
he's come out and said that as well, hasn't he?
A reputation. But I think the penalty for the Dutch is way more dubious.
Is that a bit of a suspect one, is it?
Yeah, it's Van Basten gets tackled, but I think the ball was won, personally. Ronald Koeman scores a penalty. Yes, Ronald Koeman of pulling back David Platt in qualifying for 1994. The most incredible red card that was never given that you've ever seen.
Was he a centre-back?
And a very good one. Scored the winning goal.
He took penalties.
And free kick. Scored the winning goal for Barcelona in the European Cup final against Sampdoria at Wembley in the early 90s from a free kick. Very cultured player. A proper sweeper.
Okay.
Distribution, bang, bang. The two centre-backs, Frank Rijkaard actually played centre-back in the 80s. He'd move into midfield later on, and then I think back into centre-back again later in his career. But Rijkaard, ahead of its time, Rijkaard used to push into midfield.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure he really did. Well, I just think Koeman just played a lot deeper. The centre-backs quite often then, he didn't play necessarily a side-by-side. You'd have one that was a lot deeper than the other would cover.
Is this like the Beckenbauer role? As people
Koeman,
a
lot more of that, but didn't step out like Beckenbauer. They could have the ball and you'd find him like in the 10 position and stuff. Koeman wasn't like that.
Yeah. Okay. One thing that I found from researching this one, which I didn't quite pick up on in the first one we did for the 1974 World Cup, apparently there was a lot more tension between the Dutch and the Germans because of World War II and stuff. And I didn't really pick up on that from my first one. And even this match was held in Hamburg, and it was literally like 50-50 in terms of the crowd being Dutch or West German.
Yeah, there's a song, I don't know how it goes because I don't know the Dutch language of it, but essentially translated to singing to the Germans, give us back our bicycles.
Yeah.
Because the Germans had nicked all their bicycles during the war and stuff. They did win it. Marco van Basten, of course, who else? Scored a goal that I could only describe as improvised brilliance and also a slide tackle at the same time, because he has to slide to score, and he just hits the connection so perfect at the right time as the German keeper's coming out and manages to find a corner. You can hear this weird noise when the goal goes in, which is the way you said, there's obviously a big Dutch noise, but there's also almost like a half kind of scream.
Yeah.
One of the first you might have heard at a football match of like an oh fuck, we've just blown it. Like, we're the host team, this isn't meant to happen, we've just blown it. And probably an expectation off the back of things like 74 that probably West Germany would go on to win it.
Wouters in a space here. And Van Basten! Right at the end. The Germans are lying on the ground. Distraught. The Dutch are celebrating as Marco van Basten gets his fourth goal of the tournament, the second on the night, and what a time to get it. There's no time to recover now, and the Dutch really have only to play out the last few seconds to reach the final of the European Championships.
And I think despite how good the Dutch were, it's worth remembering this Dutch team was not as good as the 74 team.
Yeah, and they were very young, right?
It was good, yeah, exactly that. I remember they didn't previous tournaments, no real qualification, etc. So they were a very good team, and it wasn't a huge shock that the Netherlands beat them, but it probably was a shock that the Netherlands beat West Germany in their own tournament.
Yeah.
There was controversy at the end. Koeman swapped shirts with Ton, Germany's number 10, and proceeded to walk over to the German fans and pretend to or wipe his ass with the shirt.
That rolled him up a little bit.
Which, he did obviously apologise for afterwards. Lost himself in the moment. It's worth remembering for this tournament coming up, which is in Germany. Who is the Netherlands manager?
It was Rinus Michels.
No, it was Rinus Michels again. Yes, the winning manager for the Netherlands. But who's the Dutch manager now?
Oh, now? I don't actually know who's the Dutch.
It's Ronald Koeman, you nutter, mate.
Oh, shit.
it'll get brought up. Do you remember when you wiped your ass with a German shirt last time you were here? Yeah, it'll get brought up. So the Netherlands through and widely expected to meet Italy in the final. So the Soviet Union, obviously two wins and a draw in the group. Really good. They'd stifled the Dutch quite a bit. In the opener when they beat the Netherlands. Michels recounts after the final that they were really happy to let the Dutch have the ball in the first game. And actually, the Dutch tried to let them have more of the ball in the final, which feels like a ahead of its time thinking a little bit. Actually, the Dutch were ahead on a lot of these things back then. But then obviously the Soviet Union were a little bit fortuitous to draw with Ireland in the second game, and also possibly a little bit fortuitous to meet an England team that were already out and made changes in the final game as well. So most still thought that Italy, remember, also won two and drawn one in probably at the harder group, that the Italians would win. But
they played each other that spring as well. And
I think Italy beat them 4-1, I think I read.
Yeah, battered them, And I don't know if you found the same, but when I was looking into this one, apparently the Soviet Union actually employed like a scientific analyst, and they did a lot of analysis on the Italians. And apparently the manager literally said to the squad on the day of the game, should we press them? And they went, yeah. And apparently they just pressed them off the park and the Italians couldn't deal with it.
Yeah, scored two second half goals. Remember who scored?
Yeah, of course I do.
And Mikhailichenko is there. And and they let him go all the way through there. It's Litichenko. And the Soviet Union have taken the lead. After a quarter of an hour of the second half, and Litovchenko was allowed to go on almost unchallenged. A solitary Soviet banner is waved to celebrate the goal, but the Italian defence won't be celebrating because Mikhailichenko opened them up, and Litovchenko evaded the last challenge. In fact, he evaded two and jabbed it nicely with his right foot. It was a tiny little finish and showed a lot of determination, and the Soviet Union lead Italy. The moment Zabarov was making life difficult for Di Napoli, and Protasov's in the middle here, and it's two goals in 2 minutes by the Soviet Union, and Oleg Protasov gets the second, and that should be enough, one would think, from the reaction on the bench and on the pitch, to give them an excellent chance of reaching the final. Protasov celebrates, and they were wide open, Italy. Zabarov got the ball in, and Protasov again, an unerring finish there, nicely lifted up by the big striker over the goalkeeper's body. But just look where Italy were. They were stretched. There were four of them there, but not one of them could get to him.
This is a really interesting point that I wanted to make on the Soviet Union. The scorers, and I have to look at their names to remember. Litovchenko and Protasov, who also got the equaliser against the Irish. And I looked back at the Russian squad. And I think sometimes when you look at these things and you look back at squads in tournaments and you think, oh, I'll look at the squad and it will jog my memory of some of the players. There's only one player in this squad that I know. And that was Alexei Mikhailichenko. And the only reason I knew Alexei Mikhailichenko is because he played for Glasgow Rangers for the majority of the 90s. Really good, really good midfield player. And he was part of that very good Rangers team that was so dominant in the 90s. But I only knew him for Rangers. I didn't know him historically through the Soviet Union in 1988.
Yeah.
What's also interesting, team of the tournament. So Soviet Union made the final. There's only eight fucking teams in the tournament. How many Soviet Union players in the final?
By the way, you said that, I'm going to guess none were in the team of the tournament.
None.
Flipping hell.
But four Italians who they beat in the semis. Giuseppe Bergami, Paolo Maldini, Giuseppe Gianni, and Gianluca Vialli, all in the team of the tournament. For the record, there was only one West German, which was Lothar Matthäus. The rest built up of Dutch players. Hans van Breukelen, Koeman, Rijkaard, Jan Wouters, Ruud Gullit, and Van Basten. But none in the team of the tournament.
Wow.
For a team who got to the final. And it's interesting. I then thought about trying to remember Russian players through history. Go on, name some.
Arshavin.
Yeah, well, I understand that. Played for you. So I'll throw you Pavlyuchenko.
Yeah, Pavlyuchenko.
Yeah.
That's it. I'm sure there's some others, but...
Kulsarar. Yeah. Andrei Kanchelskis.
I don't know who that is.
You must know Andrei Kanchelskis played for Manchester United, no?
No.
Flying winger in the early 90s. You know what Andrei Kanchelskis was? Was Ukrainian.
Ah,
Ukrainian okay. born anyway. And guess what? Most of this team was. There were more players in this team born in Ukraine region of the Soviet Union than the Russian region.
Interesting.
There were a couple of players who were...
Belarus?
There was one Belarus, I think, one Lithuanian, and I think two Georgians.
Okay.
I think I might have that wrong, but it was certainly representation from what are now those three regions. I looked at the birth dates of all these players, clearly more Ukrainians than Russians. Well, obviously, they're all together at this point. And I also thought about perhaps laziness I'd had when describing Russia previously. And I think I part know why it's happened. So it's USSR
mm-hmm.
in 1974. It's the Soviet Union in 1988 and then also 1992. And it was CIS in 1992. Now, I just thought that was just, they just changed their name a lot. It's just, right. just okay. what they did. Do you know what CIS stands for?
Nope.
So CIS stands for Commonwealth of Independent States.
Okay.
And to get Scotland into this again, Scotland beat the CIS 3-0. After the CIS had drawn with the Netherlands and West Germany in the group in 1992, proper fucked it up in the final group game, getting twatted by Scotland, who, by the way, have only scored in three of their nine European Championship games in history. They've actually only scored five goals, three of them against that CIS. And every Scottish player who's scored for him in the Euros so far is a mook.
A mook, okay.
It's a mook. So McTominay, first goal scorer, Friday night, put it in the bank.
Get your money on it.
So the CIS, Commonwealth of Independent States, is essentially after the fall of the Soviet Union, where it's all split.
Was it still made up of like the same 15 republics or?
That I don't know the answer to because my history is fucking useless. Like I didn't realize, thanks Frank for letting me know that East Germans weren't actually allowed to travel to West Germany in 1974, which explains some of the attendances. My research never told me any of that.
No, not either.
But they in 1992, they competed as the CIS because they'd already split, but they'd qualified as the Soviet Union.
Interesting.
This only happened twice in history, we think, with European nations. And the other, we might talk about tomorrow, is Serbia and Montenegro.
Okay.
Because they split prior to the 2006 World Cup, where Montenegro claimed its independence, but they'd qualified as Serbia and Montenegro. To my knowledge, that's the only time that's happened in a World Cup where a nation's qualified and it's split them and then they've still played as the qualifying nation. That's what happens. After 1992, going forward, Russia's 1990, from 1994, it's Russia.
Imagine
from memory.
Being like a huge state like that, being able to pick from 15 regions.
But also, what's also really interesting about this that I found was, so why do I remember it as Russia rather than Ukraine?
Yeah.
And it's because if you look at Russia's historical performance in tournaments, you'll see runners-up 1988. You'll see three losing finalists. This was actually Soviet Union / USSR's third loss in a European Championship final. So, but why is it them rather than Ukraine and the others? Why is it like it seems like it's given to Russia? Well, part of the reason for that is that after the tournament, going into 1990, despite the fact Ukraine had broken and had its independence, it wasn't quick enough for them to go into qualification for, I think, 1990.
Right.
Or 1992, one or the other. So, but what it meant was that the Russian team then carried all the coefficient points and everything from the Soviet Union's historically. So the Soviet Union team became the Russian team. Now, also as well, because Ukraine hadn't formed quick enough, a lot of the guys like Kanchelskis carried on and played for Russia.
Interesting. Ah, good history list.
The manager had a fairly unique career.
I think, is he Lobanovsky?
Very good. Got your first name, have you?
Gregor.
Why don't you come on over, Valerie?
Ah, close.
Spelt with an I for extra clarity. Valerie Lobanovsky. who'd managed his team, and then also went on, because he was Ukrainian, as was a lot of this team, went on to manage Ukraine later on. What I didn't realize as well was that he was club manager of the best Eastern Bloc club team that I've ever seen. Now, bear in mind, my memory doesn't go back as far as the 80s and 70s and stuff. I mean, actually seen. But he was manager of the brilliant Dynamo Kiev team in the late 90s, who you may have heard, obviously,
played. I've heard of them. Don't have many memories.
Absolutely destroyed Arsenal in Kiev, and also well beat Barcelona in the Camp Nou as well. And lost to Bayern Munich in the semi-finals. Wow. And obviously, Sergei Rebrov and Andrei Shevchenko up front. What a team. That Dynamo Kiev team was...
I'm going to have to get on the old YouTube and watch a bit of them.
What a team. They rocked up at Wembley, because they played you at Wembley. You couldn't get the ball, mate.
Bloody hell.
They equalised quite late on, but they played so well. And when I think 2 weeks later, they knew they had your number. And when you went to Kiev, you want to go and look at Shevchenko's free kick that night. 3-1 they beat you, but I think they were 3-0 up as well.
Bloody hell.
What a good team they were. And he was manager of that team as well. But they would ultimately lose to the Dutch in the final, featuring, obviously, the first goal was scored by the great Ruud Gullit.
That was his first and only goal of the tournament, wasn't it?
It was. And I also read, interestingly, though, that there was expectation going into the tournament that he was going to be, unfortunately, this comparison happens, doesn't it? The new Cruyff.
Yeah.
Well, you ain't never going to have a fucking another one of them. But he was going to be the new icon of this team, etc. And I think with his style, he was so athletic and well-built for an attacking player, was quite unusual. But he was also well-used defensively. He was all over the pitch. He could go and float from wherever he wanted to play. But he was probably quite unusual looking for like a 10, if you will. I mean, when we think of players in that position, we think... your Bergkamp, your Zolas, etc. Yeah. Gullit wasn't just aesthetically to look at, the sheer frame and size of him didn't feel like that kind of player. And he was great in the air, as shown by the first goal. But everything I've found suggests he had a shit tournament.
Oh, okay.
Which is forgotten.
Yeah, I guess it's because he went
I don't know if it was that he didn't live up to the hype and stuff, but as you said, it was his first goal in the tournament. Generally, it seems like his performance is underwhelmed. He assisted Van Basten's two of the Van Basten goals against England, but largely people seem to think that he underwhelmed against what the anticipation was, and it might have been that there was too much pressure put there.
I guess if your country wins the tournament, people aren't going to go nitpicking then, are they?
No, of course not. And then from there...
he obviously went to do amazing things.
Superstardom at AC Milan's, part of the trio from that Dutch team with Van Basten and Frank Rijkaard as well. The second goal...
This is one I've seen growing up, like you kind of see plastered around in kind of football nostalgia documentaries.
Nico
and stuff.
Had never seen it.
Yeah, I can understand that, to be fair. Because like, Nico doesn't really watch as much football, right?
How have you never seen that goal? If anybody is listening to this and never seen, doesn't know what I'm talking about, Marco, you know, you're too young or whatever, get it. Get yourself on fucking YouTube and look at this goal.
Yeah, unreal.
Because
that angle.
it's one of the most iconic goals ever scored. And I tell you what, I'd go one further to say, I think it's the most iconic strike in world football history.
Definitely up there.
I think. Yeah. I tell you why, you think of like Maradona's goal against England in 86 is like the Maisy dribble and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, Carlos Alberto's goal is well hit at the end against Italy in 1990, but it's the team move and the way Brazil play and the flamboyance. As volleyed goals, this has got to be the most iconic volley near enough ever in football, I think.
Yeah, and I think being in a final as well.
I can only explain it, for those who wouldn't have seen it, as there's a looping cross that goes towards the back post and goes over his head and is clearly overhit. It's too deep. And he manages to adjust and overhook it on the volley, on the full as it's coming over his head. And he just wallops it into the far top bin from like an acute angle that's
over the keeper.
You do it 100 times and there's every chance you won't do it once.
Yeah.
And the keeper's shocked, stunned. And you can't even look. Did the keeper get his angles wrong? Or mate, he must have thought, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
Even trying that.
Yeah, one of the best I've ever seen. Goal.
Van Tiegelen's got support here from Arnold Muren. Van Basten's on the far side of the penalty area now to volley it. Oh, I say, what a goal!
And that was their first major international title.
And remains the only one.
Yeah.
And as I said to you on the pod on Wednesday, I think they'll possibly struggle to find a second. I'm sure there will be one in the Dutch history at some point. But no, I don't think it'll be this one. No, they've got a really good collection of centre-backs, but I don't think there's enough quality in the rest of the team. You'd be very aware if you played them. It's not like the Netherlands couldn't beat an England or they can't beat France in the group. But to win the whole thing and have the consistency to do it, no. I don't think so. I'd say the Dutch team that I really remember really well was the 2008 team.
That with like Schneider, Robben.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
They weren't hugely fancied and they went into a group with France and Italy. Fuck me, did they play well. I mean, destroyed those two teams. And then everyone, it was one of them where whoever you thought was going to win the tournament, you saw them play and you went, oh yeah, they're winning it.
Yeah, like, and then you change it. Yeah.
And then they got well beat by Russia in the quarterfinals. There you go, full circle, mate.
Yeah.
Which featured an outstanding Andre Arshavin, actually.
I think we signed him in that period.
Yes, January 2008. Just after.
Yeah. 2009, even.
Cheers, Kates. Thank you. Nice enjoyed one. That. 2006 for you tomorrow, which is, again, it's a little different flavour because I was drinking by this point, so it's, I remember it well. I think, Kates, you said you were about 11 by this point.
Yeah, maybe. I've got some memories of it, yeah.
So, yeah, we'll less historical, more of a what happened, and also it's a 32-team tournament, so we'll be talking about 2006 on tomorrow's pod. Just sees me to say thank you very much, Clates, and cue music, please, Manchild.
The Fantasy Football Show.